All right, so slide 7-10, we had gotten to 7-11. Let's go back to 7-10. So in 7-10, we introduced the concept of a unit impulse, and you'd seen something like this possibly in continuous time in a differential equations class. In discrete time, this impulsive event is pretty easy to, in fact, it's very clearly defined. It's one at the origin in discrete time and zero everywhere else. You can write software for this, hardware. It's an array of numbers that are all zero except where the impulse occurs, and that element would be one. So the piecewise representation, right, it's one at the origin, zero elsewhere. If I shift it, delay it by two samples, it means it shifts to the right by two samples. And you know, if you don't remember, that's fine. You're gonna say, well, you know, whatever the argument is, n minus two, when that argument is zero, that's where the impulse has occurred. So when n minus two is zero, which means n is two, the impulse has occurred. You get that right from the piecewise mathematical representation. Now, it turns out we can build up any discrete time signal using these unit impulse signals. So here's an example. So I have x of n, right, at index minus 3 at 0. So at index n equals minus 2, we have an amplitude of 1. So we can represent this one sample at n equals minus 2 as this unit impulse of n plus 2. Okay, next sample at n equals minus 1 is at amplitude 2. So I can represent this as 2 times the unit impulse shifted left by 1. So the delta of n plus 1. At the origin, amplitude 3 looks like a triangular pulse. Right now it's a ramp, and then it'll come back down as a triangular pulse. So it's going to be at amplitude 3, so it's 3 times the unit impulse, and so forth. So we get 2 times delta minus 1, discrete time, delta n minus 2. Okay. Now, you know, you can write MATLAB code for this, right? So I index n from minus 3 to 3 inclusive. I give the amplitude values for x, read it right off the graph, 0, 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, 0, and do a stem plot. Okay. Alternatively, I can represent this as a triangular pulse, and we went through this already, and the width is n divided by 5 means I increase the width by 5 samples. So the triangular pulse is just one sample wide, and dividing by 5 gives me something that's 5 samples wide. Okay. Quite right there. So this is our, I thought something is not quite right there. So the triangular pulse goes from minus 1 to 1. Oh, that's right. Okay, so the triangular pulse So the triangular pulse goes from minus 1 to 1 in MATLAB. So its width is 2. So if you divide by 5, okay, we're going to trust but verify here. I'm going to think about that some more. I'm confused why it's working at 3, but it is. Okay. I'll follow up with email on that one. It is correct in MATLAB. Okay. When we divide by a number, we are going to increase the width of the signal. Okay, now in MATLAB, there is no discrete time impulse function built in. I checked, couldn't find one. So you could use a rectangular pulse instead, or even a triangular pulse with the right arguments to it. But that would be tough when you read the code later on, and it doesn't really make sense that it's an impulse. So in MATLAB code, you can just write an impulse, again, as a bunch of zeros, and just put a one where the impulse occurs. Okay, now more generally, we can take this idea of representing a discrete time signal by breaking it down into a sum of shifted and weighted discrete time impulses and apply that to a signal that's infinitely long. It's not constrained or confined to be finite in duration. So here I give you a signal that's a triangular pulse that is, you know, only five samples in it. So I guess that must be the 5. That must be where the 5 comes from. So the triangular pulse is one sample wide in discrete time, and the 5 gives us 5 samples wide. There we go. Right, so the triangular pulse just of n gives us an impulse at the origin. But again, if you were to read the MATLAB code for that, it wouldn't make sense necessarily that you meant an impulse there. So an n divided by 5 is going to give us 5 times as wide of a triangular pulse, which it does. Okay. For the non-zero extent. Okay, now we can take this idea, and we'll need this either this lecture or next, this notion of taking a signal that could be infinitely long and breaking it up into these weighted sums of shifted unit impulses. So any index will work here, even as we go to infinity or minus infinity, either direction. Okay, so now the impulse is a nice signal, but it turns out to be really useful at characterizing certain systems. We'll define those properties in just a bit. Again, in this lecture or next. So the impulse response is simply the response of a system when the input is a unit impulse. How meaningful that is depends on the system that we're looking at, the class of system we're looking at. But every system should have a response to a unit impulse. Now, we've talked about finite impulse response filters already, the averaging filter being an example of that, 5-point, 3-point averaging filter, whatever we're using. So when the system is a finite impulse response filter, if we put in the unit impulse, or the unit impulse as the input signal, what comes out in terms of non-zero extent are actually the filter coefficients. That's interesting. So that's a way to actually, if we don't know what they are in advance, we can send in a discrete time impulse and find them out, find out what the values are for those coefficients. Now, why is that? Well, the output, when the input's, whatever the input is, in our case, it's delta n here, our unit impulse, we know from the way FIR filters had been described earlier, is we take the input signal and we just take a weighted combination of the current and previous input values that we had seen. And we weight those according to whatever coefficient choices we have. So for an averaging filter, B of k is what value? So think a 2-point averaging filter. Coefficients are 1/2 and 1/2, and if it's a 3-point averaging filter, 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. Excellent. So if it's in general, if it's of length capital N plus 1 coefficients, then the coefficient values are simply going to be 1 over the quantity N plus 1. So this is for an average, this is an M plus one point averaging filter. Coefficients are 1 over the quantity M plus 1. Okay, so here is the slide 7-11. Here's this plot for the averaging, the filter coefficients for the 3-point averaging filter. So I have 1/3 one, I have, so I have, just reading down here, I have, some of it got hard to read here. Okay, so this is 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. MATLAB code for that. And then for a 7-point averaging filter, the coefficients are 1/7, 1/7, 1/7, all the way until the end. They're all 1/7 in value. So I'm defining these in terms of rectangular pulse, which gives us amplitude of 1, and then dividing by capital M plus 1. Okay, so let's build, now we're building our way to convolution. So for an FIR filter, this is slide 7-12. For an FIR filter, we've talked about the input-output relationship, input x, output y. Again, we just take a weighted sum, it's finite in duration, of current and previous input values. We keep, how many previous input values do we need? I think I heard it. Capital M, right? So capital M, previous input values. When k is 0, it's the current input value. And that also means if we put the impulse in, right, if the input is the impulse, then what we get out is just a sum of weighted and shifted impulses, which will give us the impulse response. Now, more generally, if I put a different input in, so it turns out now we can replace the B of K, the coefficients for our FIR filter, with the impulse response, because they're the same. At least from 0 to capital M plus 1, same values. And this is convolution. This is discrete time convolution. We'll talk about this for many lectures to come, not just today. So I have a convolution of two signals. The impulse response, the response to an impulse, right, that's h of n, and the input signal x. And filters work this way in the time domain. And there's a continuous time equivalent of this as well. So it tells me that whatever discrete time system that I have, even more general than a filter, just in general, if I have whatever my impulse response is h of n, I can always compute the output as a convolution of the input and the impulse response. So again, for general, so I'll be careful on the class of system here. So it's for a certain class of systems, which we will define in just a bit. And FIR filters are in that class, or can be in that class. We'll talk about that in a second too. So FIR filters that we've used so far are in that class. So if I know the input x, I know the impulse response h, the output is just the convolution of the input signal x and the x of n and the impulse response h. No matter how the filter is implemented, it may calculate it in different ways, but this is what the answer will be. There are many different ways to implement the system, of course, but so in the time domain, the effect of applying a filter gives us convolution effect in the time domain. So again, this is This is the algorithm to compute the output given an input and an impulse response for a large class of filters, including FIR. It also applies to infinitely long signals. It's not just for an impulse response that's finite in duration. Also works for impulse responses that are infinitely long. And those are very useful in practice as well. We'll talk more about that in a bit in the more general case for an infinitely long impulse response. All right, so let's go talk about actually some mechanics of calculating this. And we'll have demos as well to animate this process. We've already kind of seen it when I did the sliding window calculations for the averaging filters earlier in the slide deck. So another way to visualize what's happening is that I'm going to be taking this convolution again of input signal x and impulse response h, and I can expand out the summation because it's finite. Finite number of terms. So I just kind of, it's a for loop. And every time through the for loop, I get a new term. So I start with k equals 0, so slide 7-13. So when k is 0, the term that's being multiplied here is h of 0 times x of n. X of n is what? How would you describe x of n? It's the input at, well, whatever n is, right? If n is 0, it means the first input value, if we're observing starting at 0. But more generally, this is just n is the current time index in discrete time. So x of n means the current input value. Okay, so x and h of 0 is just that first impulse response coefficient. It's the same as b naught. Next term, so let k be 1, so now I add h of 1 plus x of n minus 1. So how would you describe x of n minus 1 relative to n? I heard a delay by one sample, so it's the previous input value. Keep going, right? The next term, h of 2 times x of n minus 2, so it's the input sample, or the input two samples ago, x of n minus 2. And so forth. So I can write out all these terms. So here's an example of a way to do this. So here's a x of n that has three non-zero samples. It looks like a ramp. So it has non-zero samples at index 0, 1, and 2. H of n, okay, it's a little different. It's not the averaging filter now. For where the averaging filter, the coefficients would be 1 half and 1 half, but it's something else. Okay, it turns out this is called a first-order difference. It's inspired by first derivative in continuous time. Okay, so the coefficients here are 1 and minus 1. And let's see what happens. So you can write this in a table form. So I have, across the horizontal dimension, I have index n, minus 1, 0, up to 4. I can write down what x of n is, right? So it's 0, 1, 2, 3, 0, 0. And I can write down h of n, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 0. And there are only really two terms I have to compute, right? Because my h of n is only has the two terms in it, the two non-zero coefficients. So I look up at the formula at the top of the slide here, and I just have to use the first two terms. So I have to compute h naught times x of n plus h1 times x of n minus 1, and I have my answer for the current output value y of n. And of course, I would do it for every output value that I need thereafter. So here we go. We can just multiply. This third row now is h0 times x of n, okay, or h0 times x of n. Well, h0 is 1, so that just repeats what x of n is. Okay, next row, I have h of 1 times x of n minus 1. So I have to do two things now. I have to delay x by one sample, and I have to multiply by h1, which is minus 1. So I do that. So I take x, delay it by one sample, so I have 1, 2, 3, 0, and then I multiply by minus 1. So now I have 0, 0, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and 0. And now all I have to do to compute the output value y of n is just add up the results of these, of the third and fourth row. Okay, and we're done. So we get 1, 1, 1, minus 3, and 0. In terms of implementing this in software, I look at the calculations I need. I have, how many multiply operations do I have here for this filter per output sample? So a multiplication here, one here, two multiplications, one addition. That's it, very easy to implement. So every output value, y of n, I need two multiplications, one addition, and then I have to store and keep around something. So what do I have to store for the next calculation if I were to do this sample by sample? What do I have to remember? X of n is the current input value. Don't have to remember that, I just arrived. But I have to remember the previous input value, x of n minus 1. So as soon as an input value arrives, I remember it for the, I use it, but then I also remember it for the next input sample when it arrives. Okay, so there is a memory of one location of memory to store the previous input value. Now, the MATLAB code is, simple, at least in terms of lines. So for the MATLAB code, I define my vector x, 1, 2, 3, define my, in the non-zero values, define my vector h, 1, 1, and minus 1, and there's a convolution command built into MATLAB. One and done for the calculation. Now, what other command could I have used instead of the convolution command? I know it was a week ago. I'm trying to flip back some slides and probably find it. But. Remember, I'm implementing a filter whose impulse response is h of n, 1 and minus 1. I'm applying the filter to an input signal x, amplitudes 1, 2, 3. What other command might work there? Okay, there's a command called filter from earlier in the slide set. And so what filter does is a little bit different. Filter only calculates as many output samples as you give it input samples. Convolution will compute the whole thing. So convolution will give you the whole non-zero extent of x convolved with h. So they do different things. But they do get, so filter will give this the same, the samples that come out of the filter command will be the same. So the first three samples of, in this case, the filter is two samples long. Sorry, the input is three samples long. I apply the filter command, I'll get three output values. And they'll be those three values will be the same as the first three values of convolution commands. Go ahead.
What are the parameters that you have to put in?
For filter? So for filter, you just have to give it an x and h. Now, we'll go back some slides. So if there's a third parameter that you've got to set correctly to make that work. Okay, so you'll find this on slide 7-7, for example. So the filter command takes three arguments. It takes the coefficients for the FIR filter, B, so it's just the impulse response, H. One, which is a placeholder, which we'll use this when we do infinite impulse filters that have infinitely long impulse responses. So right now it's just a placeholder for one, for the finite impulse response case, and then the input signal x. So we can try that out. To do the stem plot, I have to tell MATLAB what range of n that I want here. So I want to plot y. So I'll just tell it to start at n equals 0 up to the length of y minus 1. Oh, did I do the backwards? Oh, man. When things aren't looking good, we just clear it and close the figures. Let's try it again. Oh, no, that's fine. All right, so what you're seeing here is, let me fix the range of n. All right, you're going to solid line where 0 is at. So we've got index 0 at 0. At index 1, it's 1. Index 2, it's 1. I'm sorry, it's 1. My eyes are trying to say 1, 1, 1 minus 3. It's hard for me to see. Okay, so 1, 1, 1 minus 3. So that's correct from the convolution results. If I use the filter command, then what I get is it only gives me the first three values, 1, 1, 1. Okay, again, the filter command only gives me as many output samples as I have input samples. So I can make the filter command do the rest of it by appending zeros to x. So if I want 4 samples out of y, I need 4 samples in x. So I can change x to be one, two, three, and 0. Right, and then there it is, 1, 1, 1, and minus 3. Okay. So two different ways to apply a filter to a signal, CONV for convolution and filter for filter. Go ahead.
Convolution follows the same rules as the endpoint causal averaging filter, where it adds m samples to the end point output.
That's right, and exactly. So the question was, does the convolution follow the same pattern you had seen earlier in that extra samples get created? That is to say that the signal gets longer as a result of applying an FIR filter. That is correct. Okay, so let's go back to the slide for that. This is slide 7-6. And again, noting, let's go find the part that, so at the end, right, the convolution, remember this was a sample, this was a signal that had 41 samples in it. And when we applied the three-point averaging filter, we got 42 samples as a result. It got longer by the number of coefficients or impulse response samples minus 1. And for the 7-point averaging filter, which is on the right plot here in slide 7-6, 41 samples became 43 samples in the left plot. 41 samples became 47. Add 6. So the length of the filter is 7. I have an impulse response that has 7 samples in it. The convolution makes the, when I convolve two finite length signals, the result gets longer. Right? It's the sum of the two lengths minus 1. Okay, so length 41 on the right plot here, so 7-point averaging filter, 41 samples, that's our signal X, convolved with an impulse response that has 7 samples in it. So 41 plus 7 minus 1. And you can see why it gets wider from what we saw in the table or tableau method here that we had. In slide 7-13. You can see why it gets wider, right? So the third column, there's no change in the width of X, but the fourth column, X shifts right by one sample. So it gets, the result is one sample longer. The convolution result is one sample longer than X, which is simply, if I took the length of X plus the length of H and minus, and it subtracted one, that's the length that we get in convolution. That spreading effect in the time domain is a very important one to realize. We use it either to our advantage or we have to sometimes correct for it. Depends on the application. Okay, I do want to, the book, so now we're in section, I want to move into section 5.5-4 because we'll need this, need it for lots of reasons. One is, it's one way to visualize the calculations in a filter, and the second is, it also uncovers or makes visible some issues with initial conditions, which we'll get into in the next slide deck, in lecture 8 slides. Okay, so we want to kind of give a graphical syntax for the calculations here for the finite impulse response filter. We'll have three building blocks, multiplying two numbers together, adding two numbers together, and a unit delay, which means a delay by one sample. So this unit delay is a system in its own right, right? One input, one output. Y of n is simply the input delayed by one sample. We can combine these building blocks. Right, so the mathematics is here. Right? So I have a visual syntax and mathematical equations. You're in slide 7-14. And I want to realize the convolution here, or the FIR filter algorithm to compute output, the current output value y of n, given the filter coefficients b, k and the input x of n. So really, it looks like a lot here, but all I'm doing is taking each term of this summation and implementing it. So the first term, let k be 0, and I'm multiplying b naught times x of n. It's my first term in the summation. And I bring that down and add it to the next term. The next term, well, k is 1. It's b of 1. B sub 1 times x of n minus 1, the previous input value relative to time index n. Okay, I add that to what I've already calculated. Next term, well, another unit delay here, so I get out the input two samples ago, multiplied by b sub 2, and add that to what I've already calculated. So I just keep doing this. I have capital M plus 1 terms to compute. How many unit delay blocks do I need? Yeah, minus 1 of what? Minus 1 is right. Of? So I'm hearing, M minus 1 and M plus 1. Is there a third option? M. How about M? M's a fine choice. All right. So let's look at this case. So I had, so here M is 3, and I have 3 unit delays. All right. These delays are going to add up as I go across horizontally on this what's called a delay line. So it's a line of delays. And I'm tapping the values. Now you know why I use taps. So now I can finally define it for you. So I'm tapping the amplitude values along the delay line. Okay, so it's also called a tapped delay line, is an older name for the finite impulse response filter. Okay, so if I have capital M plus 1 coefficients, which I do here, I have capital M delay. So the minus 1 had the right insight. But it's minus 1 applied to capital M plus 1, so we get back to capital M. Okay, so that's it for this slide deck. Now, I don't have a tune-up for today, but what we'll do is, I'll know if you picked up your exam, so I'll just use that as your tune-up grade. You're here, get 100, okay, for today.